de tous ces moments. Suivez la séquence de vaccination prévue dans votre région et prenez rendez-vous à québec.ca/vaccin-COVID. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Make sure my levels are at around 8.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Blah, blah, blah.
It's kind of a tongue twister.
Am I popping my peas?
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Start again.
Oh, should I do that? Okay.
I need a script.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
So, you want me to go through it again and actually say that?
This sounds so repetitive.
See, now I can't do it. Once more, okay.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Wait, do you want me to say hello?
I'll have to do another one.
Yeah, maybe one last one.
Radio CKUT 90.3 FM.
Are you recording?
You are?
Oh. Can you press stop?
Welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. We're going to start with some music. And recently, a bear was seen in Dorval and in Pointe Claire. It was eventually captured by animal control officers. I think it was sort of a small bear. But anyways, very unusual for a bear to appear on the Montreal Island. Must have swam over here or something like that. So we're going to feature a talk by a bear researcher named Ben Killam on the first part of the show today because, you know, it's interesting that there was a bear on the Montreal Island. And so we're going to play a song by Lyle Lovett, which involves bears. And he came out with a tune in 1998 on the Step Inside This House album called Bears. So here it is.
Some folks say there ain't no bears in Arkansas. Some folks never seen a bear at all. Some folks say the bears go around eating babies raw. And some folks got a bear across the hall. And some folks say the bears go around smelling bad. Others say that a bear is honey sweet. And some folks say this bear is the best I ever had. And some folks got a bear beneath their feet. Some folks drive the bears out of the wilderness. And some to see a bear will pay a fee. And me, I just bear up to my bewildered best. And some folks even see the bear in me. See a bear would pay a fee. For me, I just bear up to my bewildered best. And some folks even seen a bear in me. They saw me to bear and take him on out to lunch with you. And even though your friends may stop and stare, just remember that's a bear there in the bunch. Just don't come no better than a bear. I sold me to bear and take him on out to lunch with you. Even though your friends may stop and stare, I just remember that's a bear there and a bunch with you. And they just don't come no better than a bear. No, they just don't come no better than a bear.
In Quebec, vaccination against COVID-19 is underway, but not everybody is protected yet. Even if you've been vaccinated, you still need to respect basic health measures, like wearing a mask, maintaining social distancing, and washing your hands regularly. You must also get tested if you have symptoms and follow self-isolation guidelines. Find out about the measures in place at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Follow all the health guidelines, all the time, no exceptions. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
And that was Bears by Lyle Lovett from his Step Inside This House album from 1998. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. So, as I said in the introduction, a bear was recently seen in the West Island of Montreal in Dorval. Apparently on Lake Avenue in Dorval, William Weston saw the bear twice in his neighbor's backyard. And animal control officers were able to shoot it with a sedation type dart, and eventually, after I think they had to shoot it two or three times before it eventually fell asleep or whatever, relocated it. But very interesting to have a bear appear here on the Montreal Island. Of course, there are bears seen occasionally off the island. I know cases in St. Lazare and in Hudson where bears have been seen. I'm sure bears probably have been seen around Mont-Saint-Hilaire occasionally in the past, but I can't remember a case of one being seen on the Montreal Island, and I'm 50 years old, so, it's pretty special. It seems like it was pretty small bear, a black bear. I thought this would be a great opportunity to play a talk by Ben Killam, who is a bear researcher who lives in New Hampshire, and he has specialized in rehabilitating orphaned black bear cubs in New Hampshire, and he's learned a lot about them, and I met him, it was probably back in 2006 or something like that. We organized this event every year in St. Anna Bellevue called Ecology Day. And I thought he'd be a good speaker. So he drove up from New Hampshire and gave a talk about black bears. And it was very interesting. And of course, these black bear cubs that he raises and then releases in the wild, they are so accustomed to him, and they view him as, a friend or a relative. And so there's all this film footage of him years later meeting up with some of these bears, which are gigantic when they're fully grown, and being able to kind of lie with it, or the bear just lying across his body or rubbing its back against him, and adorable film footage. So I was always really amazed by that. And so he has continued to do his work, and now he has a center, which is called the Killam Bear Center. And they have a website, which is the killambearcenter.org. But he has a website as well, which is benkillam.com. And his last name is K-I-L-H-A-M. He is a wildlife biologist. He was educated at the University of New Hampshire with a Bachelor of Sciences in Wildlife Biology in 1974. So we're going to play a talk that was done recently, a TEDx talk at New England College. And this was back in 2015. And he talks all about his research on black bears. This is Ben Killam.
Hi, I started working with black bears about 20 years ago, and I came at it from rather an unusual angle. I graduated from the University of New Hampshire in 1974 with a bachelor's degree in wildlife, and had hoped to go on to graduate school to do the kind of work I'm doing today. But unfortunately, I'm dyslexic, and my grade scores and test scores were well below par, and I failed to get into graduate school. As a result, I went west to a trade school and learned the art of gunsmithing, and have employed myself as a custom gunsmith over the last 30 years. In 1982, we returned to New Hampshire. My wife, Debbie, who was in the crowd, we both met at Colt Firearms. And when I returned to New Hampshire, I still had it in my mind that I wanted to do the kind of work that I wanted to do. And I had a leg up on this because my father, Lawrence Killam, who was a virologist at the Dartmouth Medical School, studied birds as an avocation. And so I grew up in a household with lots of wild animals around. When I was 2 years old, my dad went on sabbatical to Africa and brought a half-grown leopard into the house, much to my mother's chagrin. My sister Phoebe, who works with me with the bears, was one at the time, and my next oldest brother was four. He woke up one night with a leopard at the end of his bed screaming. But needless to say, we all survived and came back from Africa with two African hornbills and a Nile crocodile, which my dad raised in a basement shower until it was about 6 feet long and the National Zoo came to pick it up. But since that time, when we moved to New Hampshire, we had all the native wildlife from foxes and skunks and beaver and woodpeckers and aviaries and crows and ravens. But when my time came along, I was interested in studying carnivores, and my dad had concentrated on birds. He and my mother would sit in front of woodpecker nests and document courtship and other behavior using a pair of binoculars and a small folding chair. But carnivores were a lot different prospect to study. They were a lot more difficult. For any of those of you who've been in the woods, you know that carnivores, you're lucky to get a glimpse of them as they disappear into the brush. So I thought, based on my childhood experience, if I could get a hold of an orphan animal, raise it loose in the forest, document its juvenile behavior, and use that as a leg up on understanding its adult behavior, I would have access to a very complicated animal to study. And I wasn't thinking about black bears at the time. I was thinking about a coyote or a bobcat or maybe a fisher, the large woodland weasel we have around here. Because black bears, when I started my study, for one, I thought they were too high profile. I thought I'd never have access to them. Second, they weren't rehabilitated in most of the New England states. And so my sister Phoebe and I became wildlife rehabilitators to access one of these animals that I was interested in. But at the end of 2 years, none of those animals came our way. But fortunately, a New Hampshire conservation officer broke departmental policy and brought us an 11-month-old black bear cub that he thought had been hit by a car. And it turned out that the cub had not been hit by a car. It had no infectious disease, but definitely had something wrong with it. It was shaky, and it couldn't stay on a branch. We called it Wobbly Bear. And the bear was quickly confiscated from us because we lacked a permit to keep black bears. But later that spring, the director of Fish and Game gave us a call and said, would you take the bear back? It seemed that nobody wanted it. And I was interested in why it was wobbly, and ultimately we had to euthanize it, and we sent the brain out to the Wildlife Disease Lab in Wyoming and got a diagnosis of lysosomal storage disease, which is like Tay-Sachs disease in humans and caused by inbreeding. And this was the first documented case of this disease in a wild black bear population. But later that spring, I got a call from Frosty Hammond from Vermont Fish and Wildlife, and he had two orphan cubs. And he had heard about what I was interested in doing and asked me if I'd be willing to take those cubs. And I said, sure, but there's a small issue with a permit. And I said, if you'll talk to New Hampshire Fish and Game, I'll be happy to reconsider and take the cubs. Well, the next morning I had a permit in hand, and since that time we've raised and rehabilitated over 100 black bear cubs and returned them to the wild. Last year alone, we had over 30 black bear cubs, and this was the result of 2011, which was an extraordinarily good food year, and all the female bears that could have cubs did have cubs, followed by 2012. Which was a horrible food year, started out with 70 and 80 degree temperatures in March, which changed the food cycle throughout the year and left a lot of hungry mothers. Half of these cubs were the result of mothers being shot at chicken coops, something that's completely preventable with a nice hot electric fence with peanut butter on it. Bears check out all new smells with their tongue, and so they get experience very quickly and don't approach what's behind that fence. The work that I do is the study of behavior of black bears. And my approach to this is very different from the modern scientific method. I'm somebody who thinks in pictures and pays attention to detail, and I model my information as systems. So I model all the observations that I've made, firsthand observations, and I assemble them, and as they go together, they can only go together one way because they recognize they're a system. And my mind works that way, so I don't have to labor over this. Conventional schools were very difficult for me. Mathematics was almost impossible. Statistics was beyond my realm. But modeling in this fashion was very, very easy. It happens all the time. I can't stop doing it. And when I started doing this work, black bears were thought to be solitary animals. That is, the only interactions they had with their own kind were with their offspring and with their mates during the mating season. Unlike typically social animals like wolves and chimpanzees that live inside a territory and have all the resources they need inside that territory and a hard hierarchy for allocating resources down through family members. Bears, on the other hand, the closest thing they have to a territory is a female home range, and the females do exclude other bears from that home range. These female home ranges are evenly spaced on the landscape. Their food supply, on the other hand, is the highest quality foods in the forest, and these are unevenly dispersed on the landscape. So at any given time, one female bear may have a huge surplus of food in her home range, and her immediate neighbor can have nothing. And this, over time, leads to sharing. And what I've discovered is that black bears are reciprocal altruists and share a common social behavior background with human that parallels human behavior. The cubs that I worked with in this study were the very young cubs that came to me before they had any experience with their mother outside the den. These were the bottle feeders. I would take them for long walks into the forest and observe their very first reaction to their wild environment. Some of these bears I followed into adulthood. Squirty, who came to me when she was 3 pounds. She's currently 18 years old and will be giving birth to her 10th set of cubs. She has not only been successful in establishing in her own home range, but she's established what I call a matrilinear hierarchy. And that means that Squirty, who shares her home range with daughters and granddaughters, every time she sees one of her relatives, she will chase them. And so Squirty chases SQ2, her oldest daughter, an adult daughter SNLO, a younger daughter Brooke, another adult daughter 2, and the youngest sub-adult SQ2LO, who's the daughter to SQ2. It's linear because SQ2 chases everybody below her, SNLO chases everybody below her, and everybody chases SQ2LO. And the result of this is that Squirty has access to the highest quality foods in the greater home range. So in a marginal food year, it ensures that at least one of these females will have enough resources to reproduce. It also prevents the youngest one, if there's the home ranges are already filled by adult bears, of reproducing because there'll be pressure on her all the time. So she might not get an opportunity to reproduce until she's 6 or 7 years old, unless one of these other bears disappears for some reason. And so this allows the bears to maintain populations based on their natural foods. In these home ranges, the young males are quickly chased off. In this series of pictures, Squirty is chasing one of her grandsons. I personally watched him get chased more than 30 times. He was the target of not only his grandmother, his mother, but his aunts and anybody else who could get a bead on him. By September of his second year, he left the greater home range and joined the population of bears in the upper valley. The large males that came into my study area came in during the breeding season. These were the 350-plus pound bears. These bears, 10 to 15% of the population, do all the mating. But after they got done with the mating, they would stay and compete with the female and their cubs. But the females didn't take long not to tolerate this. Squirty, weighing about 175 pounds, is going after a 350-pound male and asking him to leave. I watched her daughter, who weighed only 135 pounds at a time, at the time do a very stiff-legged walk, zigzagging in front of a big 350-pound male. He backed off into the bushes and acted like it was no big deal, but in the morning he was gone and he never returned. This is evidence of female choice in mating, because if there wasn't a repercussion, these big males would stay and compete with the females and their cubs in the female home ranges. The big surprise came when Squirty shared her innermost resources with the neighboring females who were unrelated to her. And when these neighboring females, all of which were a clan that were related to this matriarch, a bear we called Moose, who was 15 years Squirty's senior, when these bears came and shared Squirty's resources, there was no aggression towards them whatsoever. And this suggested that there was reciprocity taking place and that these bears were indeed valuable to Squirty, because if they weren't, she could just easily chase them off. And here was another parallel to human behavior. Not only was cost counting taking place, she was judging whether this bear had value to her or not, something we do every day, all day long, with our friends, relatives, and in our economic dealings that we do. But Squirty showed aggression towards her family members and not towards strangers, and that's something that's very human as well. We would never go up and accost a stranger the same way we would verbally abuse our family members. And the reason is that our family members are our closest cooperators, and it's terribly important that we communicate with them honestly. And we can, because we can reconcile. But if we went up to a stranger and treated them the same way, they're still a cooperator, but we might not be able to reconcile. So we behave ourselves around strangers. And this parallel is what really made me realize that the bears had something that no other animal has been identified with in the non-human animal kingdom. This is something they've been looking for in the great apes for years and haven't found. And bears have all the cognitive abilities that go along with this type of behavior. The male bears brought up another problem, and They were much more difficult to study, because a male bear's home range is about 200 square miles. They could be in Vermont, New Hampshire, or Quebec. And putting radio collars on them just wasn't feasible. So I decided to use trail cameras to monitor the male bears in my female home ranges to see what was going on. I would put a small amount of corn, 1 gallon of corn, in front of a monitoring camera. And normally in a 2 week period, I could get pictures of 8 or 10 different male bears in areas where there was a concentration of activity. In 2008, I set up in a clear cut that was about 16 years old at the end of its productivity for berries and ants, bees, and grubs. And I got my usual 8 or 10 different males. And in 2009, when I set up in that same clear cut, the males were gone. The only bear that I got was a resident female. But in 2008, I had an awful lot of pictures of two males in front of the camera at the same time. And this suggested friendships or coalitions. These two males were sharing that small amount of corn that one bear could have eaten easily. And these bears were not related to each other. I've done the DNA of all the bears in my study area. We collect hair samples with hair snares, which is barbed wire. And I found that the genetic relationship of the males, they're genetically unrelated. And so this suggests that the male strategy in order to access surplus foods inside the female home ranges is to form loose groups. And this is the first evidence of unrelated animals forming together as a group, something we do as humans all the time. Here we are right in this room acting as a group. With this type of complex social behavior, one would expect complex communication, and there is with the bears. One of the things I discovered in the bears was that an accessory organ to the vomeronasal system that allows her to identify airborne scent or light molecules, and bears, all of their long-range communication is done with scent, and they're the only mammal that I'm aware of that does this. All other mammals have long-range vocalizations. That they also have a sensory nerve that comes down through the roof of the mouth, and they can hold leaves in their mouth to determine whether plants are edible or not. This is how I learned about this sensory organ. I noticed that all the cubs, every new piece of vegetation they came across, they'd hold in their mouth for a few seconds and release. At the end of the summer, I'd identified 125 different food items that they'd recognized, and many, many more that they'd rejected. Bears have emotional expression, which is facial expression. This is honest expression. It's coming from their central nervous system. It's facial expression, the intensity of their vocalizations and actions. Any social mammal has to have some means of communicating honestly its mood, and we do that with facial expression. We have the most complex facial expressions of any mammal on Earth. We have over 3,000 muscles in our face devoted for facial expression. You wouldn't be comfortable in this room if you didn't know what the mood or emotional state of everybody else in this room was, and that's written on your face. Right now, you all have a passive look on your face, which I call subway face. It's what you experience with anybody anywhere in the world. You go to get on a subway. This is Squirty after treeing a cub. She had an aggressive look on her face, and here she is with a happy face. They also have the expression of intention, and this is where they differ from other non-human animals. As humans, we have an emotional utterance that we manipulate with our lips, teeth, tongue, and larynx. So we can lie with our words, but the truth is read on our face. Bears, it's very, very similar. They have a very obvious emotional expression, and they also have an expression of intention. Other animals are thought to cry out with emotion, and others respond. Bears meet one-to-one and face off with strangers, and that's why I believe they developed this. And now they mechanically generate sounds and actions, so they chomp their teeth, they swat, they false charge, they huff, and so forth. And the meaning of these sounds and actions is based on the context of the situation. So if you meet a bear on a trail and she's got her cubs up a tree, she may false charge you, which means she lunges at you, expels a big blast of air. She wants to delay confrontation long enough for communication to take place. If you are walking out to a dumpster with a pail of food scraps, working at a restaurant, and a bear false charges you, he simply wants you to drop the pail of food scraps. Well, thank you very much. Good. Good.
And that was a talk by Benjamin Killam about the social black bear, which he studies. And that was a TEDx talk at New England College back in 2015. Ben Killam wrote two books about his experience with raising black bear cubs and about his research on black bears. One is called Among the Bears, and the other one is called Out on a Limb. You can find out more about Ben Killam and his research on black bears by going to benkillam.com. And Killam is spelled K-I-L-H-A-M. You are listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. So obviously, we're getting back into gardening in the spring season here, spring, early summer season, and, you know, growing your own food, using plants that you cultivate yourself for either food or medicine is always something interesting for many of our listeners here on Ecolibrium. And recently on Radio EcoShock in British Columbia, there was an interview that Alex Smith did with Marjorie Wildcraft. Quite an interesting last name. I don't know if she changed her name because of her profession and her life's work. But her name is Marjorie Wildcraft, and she recently wrote a book called The Grow System, The Essential Guide to Modern Self-Sufficient Living, From Growing Food to Making Medicine. And this book apparently builds from her phenomenally successful DVD series, Grow Your Own Groceries. She's from East Texas, so Alex Smith just recently interviewed her, so we're going to feature that interview now.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith. When the pandemic struck, there was a tremor through Western society. Would the supermarkets be restocked? Seed companies and supplies of baby chicks ran out overnight and stopped taking orders. Maybe we should produce some of our own food. And then when hospitals become overloaded, fearful places with the pandemic, other illness can go untreated. What could we do for ourselves at home? What a perfect time for a book showing us all how to grow our own groceries and tend to small family medical problems. What a perfect time to have homesteader and natural medicine woman Marjorie Wildcraft back on Radio EcoShock from East Texas. Marjorie Wildcraft, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much for having me back on again. It's truly a pleasure.
Well, the last time we talked in 2017, a couple of hurricanes just roared through Texas and the South. And last winter, most of Texas lost power for several days during a cold snap that seemed pretty mild by Canadian standards. And now we have the pandemic. Could there be stronger signs that we need to be prepared to get through strange times?
I would say so. And I would say the biggest thing that's facing, you know, not only Americans, all of North Americans, but globally, is inflation and possibly the threat of hyperinflation. We know that our corn, our soybean, wheat, most of those crops, the prices have increased pretty dramatically, sometimes 200-300%. People who are in the building industry are seeing that with the price of lumber and copper and those sorts of things increasing. It's countless the number of large companies, Kimberly-Clark, Coca-Cola, General Mills, that have made announcements that they are increasing the prices of their goods because the raw ingredients are costing them more and they've got to pass those costs on. So, in spite of Janet Yellen saying, no, don't worry, the rest of the world knows that inflation is here and food inflation will become a bigger and bigger problem going forward. There are globally, we have a lot of problems with the supply chain that has not gotten fixed, and some of it is so big and systemic. You know, the ship in the Suez Canal was just one thing that, you know, that'll take some months to straighten out. But there just are so many other things that are broken down. The Grow Network, we're like a relatively small company, you know, in terms of the grand scheme of things. And we sell little herbal kits to teach you this and that and the other, or DVDs or supplies. And we wanted to sell all of our herbs in glass jars, specifically mason jars, because, you know, we really believe in recycling and reusing, and we don't want disposable packaging. And last year, we could not buy mason jars. We have not been able to buy any mason jars since last July, and we really didn't want to put the herbs into plastic bags. Most herbalists are really against that. They really think that they should, you know, glass is a much better container. But we're even having a hard time getting plastic bags, not to mention we're having a hard time getting the herbs. So, you know, even if a little company like mine is struggling getting supplies and handling this, it's rampant throughout the whole supply chain. So we do have some really big problems that are not going away, and this is really a good time to have some more self-sufficiency.
Yeah, we can lean back from agribusiness and big pharmacy with a little bit of effort and self-education. So you've got a new book. It's called The Grow System, The Essential Guide to Modern Self-Sufficient Living, From Growing Food to Making Medicine. I'm wondering, does this book build from that phenomenally successful DVD series you put out, Grow Your Own Groceries? I got that. I watched that. I actually put a great big water container outside our house to collect the rainwater and change my compost system, partly because of you.
Oh, thank you. Actually, this book, we realized that video was awesome, and it did. It shocked me how many people loved that. But the primary feedback I got from that was people were really, really just beginners, and they said, could you simplify it? So the book is actually an attempt to really simplify things. So since then, we've developed what we call the Grow System, which is just a three-part system that shows you how you can produce at least half of your own food in a backyard-sized space with a 100-square-foot garden, a small flock of laying hens, and a rabbitry. And we show you step-by-step how to implement those things. And I even go through the number of calories, you know, a typical medium-sized egg has 60 calories, and, a flock of six chickens can lay 1,500 eggs, and that's almost 100,000 calories a year. So I show you, you know, And I show you what it looks like from day to day, how to operate that, and what size chicken coop you have, and where the plans are to build it. And, you know, we really take you step by step on how to produce half of your own food in a backyard size space. And then we go through a little bit on home medicine. And again, starting very simply from people who have never done anything with the 7 stages that you go through as a medicine maker, the 8 preparations that every home medicine maker knows. And then how to get started with just, you know, what should be your first herb or two to start with. So it really is a book that's targeted more to beginners, because we found that was really the need. And, yeah, but thank you so much for the comments on the DVD. It's still a classic.
Well, speaking of gardens and ground, I notice and I feel in my heart that I'm healthier when I have my hands in the soil. Do you think grounding, also known as earthing, is a real thing for good health?
It's a real thing, absolutely. Having your bare feet on the ground. Lots of women notice that when they're digging in the dirt, their nails are stronger. And there actually is a direct connection between your gut microbiome and the soil. They're very, very similar entities. They're microbiological entities that help basically digest and get nutrients moved around. And, you know, there's actually quite a few people that recommend you just eat raw dirt because of the biology that's in it is similar to what you need in your gut. So, yeah, absolutely. That the soil is so much more. People think, oh, it's just dirt to hold the plant up, and it's something I don't want in my house, right? No, no. There's so much more going on with soil. So, yes.
Yeah, my buddy across the street, Joe, he's been gardening in the same plot since 1960. So what he does is he takes about a seventh of the garden, digs a great long trench, and all his neighbors come over with their lawn clippings and their backyard leaves that they don't want, and they fill up his trench. He puts the dirt back. And so 1/7 of his garden is replenished each year. But even so, he lost about 2 inches of soil over 40 or 50 years.
Really? Huh. Wow, that sounds like a great system. You know, I have been to Mexico to visit the Tarahumara Indians, who are the world's fastest long-distance runners, these guys, and they're also really famous for their longevity. And a couple of things struck me, and one was they didn't accept someone with our group had brought a bunch of corn that they bought from the grocery store, and they would not accept it. They very politely declined it, and they said, that food, it's not going to fuel us the way that our own homegrown corn is going to fuel. And I went to visit. I particularly wasn't going there to run. Oh, my God, no way. but I was going there to talk to them about how they grew their food. And we went to fields that had been in production for centuries. And Juan Sencio in particular was the farmer who was operating it now. And he knew of his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather that had worked that particular soil. And they used goats. The kids would herd the goats during the day up into the hills, and then at night they would pen them up in a pen, and they would collect all the manure from the goats that had been there overnight. So they were basically collecting minerals from the surrounding mountainsides, and then they would apply that goat manure to those fields. And they had that dialed in so successfully that really for centuries they had been growing corn every year there. So, gosh, it sounds like your neighbor Joe has a really good system, but maybe he needs some more or something, right? I don't know.
Well, he fed 6 or 7 kids partly from that. So I think he did pretty good. Now, I'm thinking of my listeners here, Marjorie. There's a whole crowd of people who have a few acres and the desire to grow food. But there's an ocean of folks living in apartments or condos downtown, hardly any access to a patch of ground. And in between, we have a lot of people in suburbs where the big crop is lawn grass, as you know. So
yeah.
Who can participate in this grow revolution? That's what I'm asking. And who gets left out?
Well, everybody can participate in it. And this book is actually targeted more toward a suburban-type lawn, so a small backyard-type place. In fact, you can have chickens, rabbits, and a garden in about the size of a 3-car garage, right? So I've really dialed these systems in to be able to grow them in small, compact spaces and yet do it in a way that's, you know, healthy and beneficial for the animals and the plants, that you're not overdoing it with crowding. Obviously, if you have more space, everybody's going to be a little more comfortable, but you can really grow this in a backyard, and that's what it's targeted at. But we do have a lot of people in condominiums and apartments, and there's a lot of the classic answers to that of, you know, community gardens, you know, get a space. There's a lot of guerrilla gardening of, hey, is there a vacant lot over there? Can you use that? There's resources on the web now. Shared Earth is a website where you can go, and it connects up homeowners with backyards they're not using with people who want to grow food. But there's also a lot that you can do. There's the traditional, you know, growing things on a windowsill or a balcony, or even just growing sprouts in your house, which really doesn't even require any sunlight. I'm actually thinking of getting some quail and doing them inside just as a demonstration that you could actually produce quail, which are meat and eggs, in an apartment, partly grow the fodder for them, which are just sprouts, and then, of course, you know, feeding them feed. They're, you know, delicious little birds, and they make these great little super nutritious eggs. So there's lots of things that you can do. And I'm also a huge proponent of, you know, when you just set your mind and your intention and you open your heart and you go, I really want to grow food, and you ask the universe for help, it's astonishing the resources that will come to you.
We got some hens that were 14 weeks old back last March. And they were hard to find because everybody wants to raise chickens all of a sudden. But we got the 14-week-old hens, just as your book suggests, because the chicks can be tricky to take time to know how to do that. Now we're getting 3 eggs a day. We can only have 3 chickens due to our municipal bylaws, but that's plenty. That's as much as we can keep up with. We end up giving away a dozen every now and then to our neighbors.
Nice, yeah. I actually normally recommend people have, if you have the space for it, to have 6 hens. And part of it is because they're flocking animals or creatures, and they're always worried about safety and security. And when you have 6, then one person, you know, one hen is on duty looking while the others are eating, and you can divide it 6 ways. And if you have, it's terribly cruel just to have a single chicken by itself, right? Because then it has a hard time putting its head down eating while it's worrying about its own safety and protection. But you're absolutely, they're so prolific. I mean, a hen in her best laying years is going to produce about 250 eggs a year. That's a lot of eggs, you know. You're right. Yeah, you'll end up, that's the great thing about it. You'll end up giving away a lot of eggs. You'll end up being super popular at potlucks with all those deviled eggs, you know. Who doesn't love a dozen fresh eggs from somebody's backyard as a gift, right? Incredible food.
With those golden yolks that you just can't get in the supermarket. Back in 2011, I interviewed an original urban homesteader, Jules Gervais. And in California, with a family to feed, he took a standard urban lot. It even had some concrete all over it and turned it into a year-round food growing place and then a commercial success. And I've been growing backyard food for decades. But in your book, I was inspired. You want folks to take it farther to the neighborhood and then a community food web. Talk to us about those next steps.
Yes, absolutely. We have to absolutely have to rebuild the local food shed. I call it a food shed. We have to. It's we're so dependent on the big commercial agricultural systems, which we're seeing are breaking down. They're providing, they're not growing nutritious food, and they're hugely polluting. I believe, after looking at this for a long time and living in different aspects of community, the best thing is for each family to have its own individual garden for the more immediate things, you know, the salads and the greens and whatever their particular tastes are. And then calorie crops are actually really, really better suited to growing as a community. And what I mean by calorie crops are potatoes or corn or root crops, you know, the things that generally are big, starchy, calorie-type things. And the reason they're so good to grow in community is normally you need a bigger space for them, and they tend to need a lot of hands all at once in short bursts. So when you're planting, you need everybody there, you know, and then you need everybody to come back a few weeks later to maybe do some weeding, and then everybody maybe to come do some fertilizing, and then another weeding, and then when you do the harvesting, you know, it just makes sense to have a lot of hands helping out. But also, you know, growing calorie crops together, oh my gosh, you know, the bonding and the relationships and it's valuable, meaningful work for everybody at every age, you know, even from the little kids all the way up to the elders. For me, it's something I think that all of us have really been hungering for anyway for a long time.
You are listening to homesteader, homegrown expert, and family medicine woman Marjorie Wildcraft. This is Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith. We're getting to your new book, The Grow System, The Essential Guide to Modern Self-Sufficient Living, Marjorie. And I admit to worrying about reading the next segment. There's so many quacks out there selling anything for a buck to sick people. A couple in Florida were just arrested selling so-called mineral water that was toxic as a cure for COVID-19. How can we steer clear of the fake stuff when we want to learn about natural medicine?
Oh my gosh, I hadn't heard about that, but it doesn't surprise me. You know, COVID-19 has caused all kinds of insanity from everywhere. Well, I would say, you know, go to somebody who's actually been doing this for years and years and really knows it. The system that we've developed, I've been living this for basically the last 20 years, and I've taught, gosh, at this point, hundreds of thousands of people. We have tens of thousands in the Grow Network who are doing the Grow Half system, and we have so many herbalists that we've created, you know, that I would just recommend you go with somebody you know that you trust. I totally get you about the there is a lot going on, and there's an explosion now of homesteading things and all sorts of stuff. People are definitely, it's mainstream to be a prepper now. You're no longer a tinfoil hat wearer if you're talking about the end of the world. So there is an explosion of that. But
well, what kind of problems have you solved with your own family?
Oh, my gosh. You know, with the herbal medicine, I suppose the most famous story, which is one we wrote in the book, was I got bitten by a copperhead snake, which is potentially a fatal snake bite. And we totally treated that at home very simply with home medicine. All kinds of, you know, conjunctivitis, which is an eye infection, tooth infections, lacerations, fevers, cold, hypothermia, all sort of coughs, sore throats. And then I'm really big on using herbal medicine. The best use of herbal medicine is just very slowly and gently and proactively. So a thing I love to do is make an herbal infusions out of deeply nourishing herbs and just drink that every day. So I'm naturally strong and healthy, and building your own immune system is actually the best medicine, right?
You also kind of turned me around in the garden department because you said we might learn to love our weeds. Well, I've got one, quack grass, I call it. It's an invasive grass by the root. I'll never love it. I always get rid of it. And the only animals I know that eat those roots are pigs. Chickens won't. But I have to give another weed a chance after reading your book. I never knew the pesky mallow plant could be good for me. What's your favorite medicinal plant, Marjorie, that we could have in our gardens?
Oh, my gosh. You know, I have to say one of the most common ones that I love the most, I love the mallow, too, by the way. I love those little, when it makes its little seed head, it's kind of this little green wheel. Some people call them little cheese wheels. And you can eat them all the way from when they're tender green all the way to even when they harden up a little bit, they get crunchy. But one of my favorites is just the humble and lowly dandelion. It's just so common everywhere. The tender leaves in the springtime are wonderful to saute up as a bit of a bitter green. I love the bitter greens all throughout their growing season to take just a bite or two of it before eating something else, 10 to 15 minutes ahead of time, and that bitter taste will get your digestive juices going and help you digest whatever meal you're going to eat. And then the roots, roasted and ground, is a great coffee substitute. Oh, my God, you do not need to see me on coffee. It's not a pretty sight. I don't need more caffeine. So I like the coffee substitute of the roasted dandelion root. And then the flowers, oh, they're delicious when they're yellow, and then they're so much fun when they turn to seed and you can blow them. We call them wishing flowers, and you make a wish and you blow the seeds out, and the seeds will go plant your wish for you. So I love the humble dandelion.
It is amazing. There have been medicine people for thousands of years, and you would think over that time that humans would have learned a few things that really and truly do work. But also, I was relieved to see you put in the book, look, if you break a leg or you've got something really a serious disease, go see a doctor, go to the hospital. It's not like you're against the medical system, as I understand it.
it's my plan B, and then I also, maybe my plan C or D, actually. And then I also do have a network of trusted healthcare providers. You know, I usually know an acupuncturist and a chiropractor and an herbalist or two, and, you know, like, you know, if something goes wrong, you do want to have, you know, I, like I said, I'm a home medicine maker, right? I treat minor things that come up in my family, and when something bigger comes along, I usually seek help outside. And yeah, the traditional, the regular medical system, I find, I love going and getting blood tests. Actually, I'm just going to get some next week. The diagnostics are amazing, right? Like CAT scans and all these x-rays, like what they can see inside of you. Their treatments aren't always the best, but boy, do they have some great diagnostics. You know, don't throw the whole system out. But yeah, you know, I mean, let's look at strengths and weaknesses and everything.
We need to make this a full season thing, and it just feels way better than Money in the Bank to have a lot of bottles of food down in the basement and big bags of carrots and sand and potatoes in their sacks. I feel rich when I've got that.
Me too. Yeah, there's nothing more enjoyable than going into your pantry and seeing the neatly lined up rows of green beans and different things that you've canned, and tomatoes. Of course, the taste is phenomenal also. But yeah, having a pantry, especially a pantry full of homegrown food that I've stored, is amazing. But if you don't have that, then, you know, go out and buy some supplies. But it's really wisdom at this point in time. Like I said, you know, pre-2008, people thought you were nuts. You know, 2010, 2012, they started selling backup food supplies at Costco, and it started to become a thing. I think everybody is a prepper now, and I think everybody realizes. And Alex, quite frankly, I really this decade is going to be very, very turbulent. You know, quite a few of the larger entities on the planet, like the World Economic Forum, is saying 2021 may be a year that may make 2020 look like an inconvenience. So Texas certainly has experienced that already. I don't know what's coming, but I do feel a whole lot happier and more secure knowing that I can grow food and that I've got some stuff stored up and I know how to make medicine and family and community are nearby and I'm doing meaningful work, you know. So that really is so much more important than money.
I agree. We've got to wrap this up now. Where do we find your new book, and how do we hook up with this self-sufficiency movement that you help coordinate?
Yeah. You know, if you go to MarjorieWildcraft.com, the book is available there, and then we also have a whole bunch of other bonuses for you if you sign up through there. And when you go there, there'll be, like, all the options for Amazon and Barnes & Noble, whoever your favorite is. But if you go to MarjorieWildcraft.com, and then we'll also get you hooked up on our newsletter, and we have a super active forums area with lots of experienced homesteaders from all over the world now. So that way there'll always be somebody in your region or a similar growing region that will know what you need to know. And yeah, and our newsletters are fun, and we're really here to serve. You know, I've always known that something like this would happen, and that's part of what we built the Grow Network for. So if you go to MarjorieWildcraft.com, that'll get you the book, and I think there's a lot of good stories in there. I tried to make it as entertaining, as informative as possible.
And I'll put some more links to all of that in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Marjorie, it's always a treat to talk with you. Please come back soon.
I'll do that. Thank you again, Alex. Super appreciate you.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
And that was an interview from Radio EcoShock by Alex Smith with Marjorie Wildcraft, the author of The Grow System, The Essential Guide to Modern Self-Sufficient Living, From Growing Food to Making Medicine. You have been listening to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. That's all the time we have left on the show today. Thanks for listening. And you can always email us at ecolibrium@ckut.ca, and you can follow us on Facebook. We're easy to find, Ecolibrium CKUT Montreal. We also have a podcast on Spotify, which is called the Ecolibrium Radio Podcast. I don't know if you can hear the Northern Cardinal in my, there it is, singing outside my window. Classic. So thanks for listening. And you can always follow me on Twitter at Ryan V. Young. And I'm also on Instagram at Ryan Young Naturalist. We're going to leave you with a song about gardening. And this is called Plant Me a Garden by Jack Marks.
Man walking down the street just the other day, spied a woman that he thought he ought to ask to go away on a fishing trip with him, flipping through the magazines with them wedding dresses in them, every little girl's dream. She said, oh, wait a minute, Mr. C, you don't believe I met you, the one looking silly over by the swing set. Never make you think I'd want to make your bed. Well, I never liked fishing much, and this is what he said. They ought to plant us a garden, plant a whole patch of peppers. True, but I ain't got a whole lot better to do. You can keep your fishing rods and keep your magazines, but if you take them for a ride, then I'll tell you my dream. Won't plant me a garden, plant a whole patch of peppers. Talk, honey, like the way you think, but we ought to have some other things to keep us in the pink. Maybe we can get an apiary, have ourselves some bees so we can make some honey, honey, underneath the trees. And we'll get us some chickens, and we won't even eat them. We'll just give them all names, let them run around the place and go out there and feed them.
Feel it, feel it, feel it, feel it, feel it. The following is a previously broadcast program.
Noam Chomsky, speaking from MIT. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. Here we go. Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo. Here we go, yo.
Watch this. Watch this, here we go again. You want a friend, booming in your Jeep like it ain't no thing. Uptown, downtown, all around town. Driving, booming and listening to the sound of the S-E-R-E-E-C-H-Y. Music sweet, you pump it up high. I spy, what do I spy? Fly, girls as you're passing by. Walking, rocking while the system pump. Not crisscross, but you make them jump to the beat while booming up the street in your Jeep. Screechy, give your lyrics to a leap. Watch that Terry in my rap to the beat. Mervyn Jordan, love off the beat. Inna your burgundy color pathfinder, your Cherokee Jeep or your Land Cruiser. Inna your whatsoever, which one you prefer? Put in a cassette or flick to the tuner. Pump up the volume, then fix equalizer. While